It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Media outlets from around the world reported every turn of this story. The case was covered by every news magazine on television. Caitlin Armstrong murdered Mariah Wilson and fled to Costa Rica. Join us for the most in-depth story of the fugitive hunt for Caitlin Armstrong. We've got new information and insight that has yet to be revealed to the public. I'm Chris Gotzik, and this is Chasing Evil. And today we're in Austin, Texas, with the U.S. Marshals Lone Star Fugitive Task Force, and we've drawn quite a crowd. From the Austin Police Department, also assigned as task force officers to the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force, we have Jonathan Riley and Mark McLeod. From the U.S. Marshals, Deputies Amir Perez, Damian Fernandez, Brandon Fila, and Chris Rhodes. But wait, there's more. We're delighted to be joined by Susan Parmelo, who is the U.S. Marshal for the Western District of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you say you're joining us with the flagship office, the Austin office of the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force?
I would say that this is a unique office because we have such a great relationship with Austin Police Department.
All right, we'll take that as a yes. So this is the number one office in... This case was a love triangle that is not unfamiliar. Caitlin Armstrong lived with Colin Strickland, who was a racer, and they were in business together. And he met Mariah Wilson, who goes by Mo, and she was a rising star in the gravel professional racing circuit. And they got together and had a fling on and off. No one knows exactly how long it went on for. And Caitlin Armstrong showed up at her house one night and murdered her. We are going to start with Jonathan Riley and Mark McLeod, who are with Austin PD.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Basically, our main focus as APD officers on the task force is, first off, to our own agency, we're responsible for helping homicide, robbery detectives with identifying and then helping them collect evidence to get to a warrant for someone.
Okay.
And so there's always two of us on call from the task force that are with APD guys. And basically that night I was on call with another task force officer. Homicide called us asking for assistance with what they were working that night. So basically their detectives responded from homicide to the scene and they started to interview people and they just
asked, what did you know at the time?
First off, we learned that the female that had been shot, her name was Mariah. She went by Mo, and she was a cyclist. And we learned that she had come into town for a race, and she was staying at a friend's apartment. Mm-hmm. We started to learn from, and I don't remember the person's name that she was staying with, mm-hmm. but we started to learn from her details about when Mariah got there and what she was doing that night. Because Mariah came in and was spending the night at this residence of her friend, but they went their separate ways that night. So Mariah was given a code to the door. There was an access code for the door, so she could come and go as she wanted.
Right.
So basically, the friend was filling in blanks with the detectives that, hey, she had gone out to dinner with her friend Colin Strickland. So as we started to learn that she would have gone out with Colin Strickland, we were also getting video that was from Ring doorbell cameras in the area. Mm-hmm. That video showed a black SUV with a bike rack on it. So we started to look into who Colin Strickland was. Obviously, Mo had the background of riding and just kind of went down that rabbit hole of what's the relationship there. Typically, I guess, you know, a lot of the time it's the simplest answer. The people that you know are around are usually the ones. We don't get a lot of stranger homicides, right? They're right. Usually typically, you know the person, there's some sort of intimate knowledge there. Mm-hmm. And so as we started to look more and more, right off the bat, my first thinking was, well, this is going to be Colin Strickland went out something happened with Mo, and, you know, thinking she told him something about their relationship. Maybe there was, maybe she said she was pregnant or something along that line. You start to go through all these scenarios that right. would make Colin get to the point of shooting her that many times in a personal manner. There didn't look like there was any forced entry
right.
into the apartment. So you're
so
thinking,
Colin was a oh, natural
yeah.
suspect.
Yeah, natural suspect right okay. off the bat. And in your mind, you're starting to think about, okay, you know, we knew Colin was living at this house and started to look at, well, it looks like he has his girlfriend. So maybe this is, you know, something was going to come out that was going to ruin this relationship.
Right. And
so
his girlfriend was Caitlin Armstrong.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so at first you're just starting to go through the natural thoughts that, okay, well, this is going to be him. And then after, you know, looking at the car and saying, well, he's got a car and starting to go down that he's linked to that car, it's just natural to think, well, Colin's going to.
And what car was that?
Well, he had access to the black Jeep that was seen on surveillance.
Right.
With
okay.
the bike racks.
And who was the owner of that car?
It was going to be Caitlin Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
So Caitlin owned the car, but we knew they lived together. So very easy to have access to it.
Right.
From there, just that's our first thought is like, all right, so Colin, where does he live? We start to go through on our end for APD, just trying to verify all the stuff that we know.
First thing the morning after, so this would be the 12th, APD Intel Unit officers who are task force officers went and started doing surveillance at Colin's house. And sure enough, that black Jeep with the bike rack was parked in the driveway. So we're feeling, you know, we're on the right track. At one point, the detectives investigating the homicide made the decision that they were going to go out and make contact with Colin.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually agreed to come in and speak with them.
Right.
And so I'm sitting up the homicide office, kind of coordinating between our team of officers and the homicide detectives.
You're wearing two hats. You're working with the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force, but at this point, you're acting in your capacity as an Austin police officer. So at the moment, this case has not come to the U.S. Marshals Lone Star Fugitive Task Force.
Correct. And that was part of the model of our unit in APD, so that not only can we help the homicide detectives solve their case,
right,
having the intimate knowledge of the case from the beginning, when it switches over to a task force operation and is adopted by the U.S. Marshals, we already know everything about
right.
the case, and it makes us that much more effective and efficient on the fugitive side.
Right. Okay, so right now you're in the process of an investigation and trying to identify who might be your principal suspects.
Yes. So Colin, he comes to the homicide office and is speaking with detectives, and it is his story that detectives are eventually able to corroborate, that he actually, when he meets up with Mo that night, he's on his motorcycle.
Uh-huh.
And it eventually comes out, he says that he never drives the black Jeep. 100% never drives it.
Uh-huh.
And so with that statement and video that's coming in that's corroborating that he actually took Mo on the motorcycle swimming and to get dinner that night, the investigative kind of gears in our head start changing, like, okay, maybe right. maybe we need to be looking right. at Caitlin.
Because intentionally or unintentionally, the way it is now with these security cameras and Ring cameras, there's going to be a camera somewhere in the city of Austin that's going to catch you and either confirm your story or poke a hole in it.
Correct. Yeah. And in this case, there was a lot of cameras that captured him on the motorcycle.
Okay.
And I think one of the things, too, when the detectives first went to the house to talk to Colin, they noticed a female was inside. They didn't know who she was.
Uh-huh.
So they were talking to Colin out in the driveway. And they kind of relayed it before he came in with the questioning was, you know, do you want to, like, who's that? And he's like, well, that's my girlfriend. And so then they were like, hey, man, do you want to come down and talk to us? Because this is going to get sticky, right? Like, do you want to have this out in front? So we kind of right. knew when they got there that there was a girlfriend in the house. So we're listening to them talk and ask him questions, just like, you know, we're watching the interview on the TV. So as he starts to talk, then we're starting to like, oh, he's mentioning this, like they went to Deep Eddy and he's on a motorcycle. So then we're having other officers go out and start to look at for that film and start to bring it back and say, yeah, we've got images of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the point where, like, is he's saying the timeline, we're looking at, well, he's saying he dropped her off at this time and he got home at X time. What's the most likely route that he would have gone on his bike? how long would it have taken him and got home to kind of corroborate all of that. And plus we had a door, we had a timestamp that she entered back in from putting the code. It sends an alert to her friend that the door was just opened, person that owned the house. So she knew that Mariah must have entered. And then when you have the timestamp, you can tell that it's like, you know, very close to the time the door was opened to the time the car is seen and all of that stuff as well.
So he left pretty immediately. That's the evidence supports that.
Yeah, yes. Him saying, I just dropped her off at the bottom of the stairs, because it was a stairs up to the apartment, and then leaving was pretty spot on time-wise.
Okay.
So the realization's made that, okay, we're starting to kind of turn our focus towards Caitlin. We learn that she actually has a misdemeanor warrant out for her arrest for theft of service. We would later learn that it was from a Botox treatment that she basically kind of skipped out on the bill. So in consultation with the homicide detectives, we made the decision to make an arrest of Caitlin on that misdemeanor warrant. We still had team members, APD TAC Intel members, still out at the scene. And a few of us, including myself, actually went out to supplement them to help out. And we made an arrest for that warrant and brought her back to the homicide unit.
And you were there when the arrest was made?
Yes, I was.
And what was her demeanor when she realized she was under arrest?
She was pretty quiet. She didn't really say much. She kind of looked a little bit shocked. She was very cool, though. Didn't say anything. Wasn't excited.
What would you have expected to see if it was somebody who had committed a murder? What kind of tell would you expect to see?
I don't know, but I wasn't expecting kind of the lack of a response by her. The way that she didn't really respond to me was different than what I would expect. I would expect some reaction, but she was very cool and collected.
So I wasn't out there. And did they tell her, like, what the warrant was for? Because normally, sometimes, depending on what it is, we just say, we have a warrant for your arrest. We don't say what it's for. So I don't. Did they tell her it was? And because I was in the back at homicide, so I'm just curious.
I don't recall, because I was out there, but I wasn't the first to make contact with her.
Because that changes their demeanor sometimes, what they, if they know what they're going for or not. You know, they shut down or they start to go out, no big deal, right?
Yeah, certainly misdemeanor and murder have two different, you know.
Yeah, $750 Botox Class B misdemeanor in Travis County. I mean, she even, I know we took a lot of heat for that because there was some question on, like, was there enough information on the warrant and stuff like that to be sure? And we took a lot of heat on that because they end up not going through with the warrant arrest. And a lot of that, I mean, it would have been inconsequential in my opinion, because she would have literally, with no criminal record, walked into Travis County, presented her ID, valid ID, and probably beat us out the door from filling out the paperwork.
Right.
When we arrested her on the warrant, she was like wearing like workout type clothing. She didn't actually have her ID on her. And so when we brought her back to the homicide unit office and they were talking to her, I started doing research on her to check involvement in our system, APD, to see, do we have involvement with her? You know, what can I learn from that? And so what we actually had in our system for her was a different date of birth than what was on the warrant.
Right.
And so I start questioning, okay, is this warrant actually for her? Because looking at the warrant return in the system, it didn't have very much other than a California driver's license, her name, and date of birth. Through that system, I don't have access to photographs directly from the state of California. That's something I would actually have to put in a request, put in a request for. So
Would that kind of mistake make the warrant void?
If the date of birth was different on a warrant than actually what the person's date of birth was, I would not feel comfortable arresting that person, because especially if they don't have ID on them, because I have to be sure, you know, I'm putting someone in jail, I'm depriving them of their liberty. And so I would err on the side of protecting their rights and not taking them to jail.
Calling all lovers of mystery. Prepare to don your detective hat in June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. Take a trip in time to the glitzy 20s and play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. The thrill is endless, with new chapters added weekly, allowing you to not only enjoy the detective adventure, but also to personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island, where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
So homicide detectives conduct their interview of her. I watched it. She really didn't say anything at all. So after talking to her, they eventually get to a point where the interview is not progressing, mm-hmm. and she is no longer under arrest, and so she's free to go. And so what one of our officers actually transports her back to her house.
Right. And this is what some of the heat that you guys caught. Like, wait a minute, you know, you had the person who everybody thinks did it. Right. How could you possibly let her go? And the way the system is, and I guess the amount of evidence that you have supporting your theory wasn't there.
Right. And at this point, she's not being charged with homicide, and you have to err on the side of caution. If you're going to arrest someone, you better be right, mm-hmm. because now it's not just a Class B warrant that you're arresting them for. You're also potentially changing the course of a homicide investigation, and this homicide investigation is a lot more important than a Class B warrant for theft.
Check.
And at that point too, like, having listened to the interview and talking to you know, hear them talk about him having access to guns, and they have guns together, and they've bought guns, and they're at the house. You know, we can arrest her for the Botox, but at the end of the day, it's going to take a while. It's not like on TV, right? We're right. going to get these ballistics back in five minutes.
You got about an hour,
right?
And then you better wrap this up.
Right, exactly. So right. It's kind of one of those deals where, you know, it's going to take a while. So we're just sitting there going, all right, well, this is going to be a while anyways for ballistics. Just because she owns a gun doesn't mean anything. I mean,
right.
A lot of people in Texas have guns, so.
Right. And then the gun was found.
Yeah. So while this is going on, other homicide detectives are also writing search warrants and then eventually conducting a search warrant of Colin and Caitlin's residence. So two guns were recovered from the residence. It wasn't until the 17th when the ballistics report came back on the guns that were seized that indicated that the gun that belonged to Caitlin was the firearm that was used in the homicide.
Right. So it's a week later, and now some evidence is starting to emerge.
So the ballistics report, in combination with the video evidence and then other evidence that was gathered, that was enough to finally say on May 17th, that the detectives believe they had probable cause to obtain an arrest warrant charging Caitlin Armstrong with murder, mm-hmm. and they presented that warrant to a judge, and the judge issued the warrant on May 17th.
Okay.
So now that the warrant's signed for homicide, homicide's obviously a violent crime, and violent crime is one of the key factors for a warrant being adopted by the United States Marshals Service. And so once we have that warrant, this now becomes a task force case.
Okay.
Now I have a question, just I guess for my own peace of mind. Were you guys keeping tabs on Caitlin at this time? Not having a warrant yet issued out, was APD still on top of her?
So at this point, Caitlin's kind of a ghost. We're keeping in contact with Colin, and Colin has provided some information about that she obtained a new cell phone because her cell phone was seized during the search warrant, but he has not seen her. She has not returned to the house.
Uh-huh.
And so we're keeping an eye on the house, but she hasn't been back.
Right.
So after you guys dropped her off, because APD dropped her off, right, at her house?
Yes, while the search warrant's going
on. And then after that,
on.
She probably grabbed her stuff and bounced.
Yeah, so we'd learn later on, like, we basically, when we dropped her off, they're executing the search warrant. It took a couple hours, so she's waiting outside. And then she's at the house. Colin was still, he spent a long time at the main talking into the afternoon, even when the search warrant was going on. If I recall, it was there for a while. And so they were watching the house, and then he would go on his way, and later on we'd find out that he didn't, did he go back to the
he
house
went,
that?
He went out of town
he
to
didn't,
stay with
Yeah, he didn't feel
family.
Comfortable going back to the house that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I'd blame him after what he learned. Because in his mind, well, I mean...
Look, she's potentially killed well, once.
Yeah, he saw that. I mean, if you're Colin and, you know, I don't know if they showed him the video or just told him that the Jeep was there. I can't recall. But he knew that, like, hey, I'm telling you that he dropped her off, but you're telling me this Jeep that I don't have access to is right there on camera afterwards. I mean, if I'm him, I'm kind of putting one and one together and going, okay, this isn't looking good in my mind. I would be, not to mention he's telling the detectives that he's not putting Mo on the phone, in his own phone, under Mo, because Caitlin gets jealous.
Right.
Same with him. I wouldn't have gone back to the house either. Right. I'd be like, I'm not going to risk this.
Right.
I think one thing that we did mention is that the murder was like on the 11th and the warrant came out on the 17th. So I think to Damien's question, it wasn't like there was full-time surveillance on Caitlin.
So when we were told about how Mariah was found, all right, multiple gunshots, almost looked like it was execution style. There was some running away from the person, but there was no forced entry. It started to make us think that she had to have known the person.
Right.
To let them into the apartment right. because the door wasn't locked. So when we're sitting at the table and we're thinking that it's Colin because we find out that she went on a date with them,
mm-hmm.
it's like, hey, this is going to be the guy. But then as it unfolds and we start to learn that it's not Colin and we start to shift over to, all right, well, he doesn't drive this truck and there's another person that's viable, Caitlin.
Right.
I guess we're just trying to go down every avenue that as the evidence presents itself. Mm-hmm. So even that day when we bring in Caitlin and then she walks out. So in my mind at that point, when we tell her that she's not under arrest anymore, or Detective Connor tells her that she's not under arrest anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And she asks her specifically, like, hey, you don't want to explain to us like how your car is at the scene of a murder around the corner. And she just didn't answer. She just kind of shook her head or said no, or kept asking, can I leave? And Detective Connor was like, yeah, I told you could leave if you want, but not saying, yeah, get up and go. She right. wanted her to make that move. Right?
Right.
So when I know Riley and I were there, and when she finally leaves that day and she gets up out of the office, we obviously look at each other and are like, that's not a normal reaction. Like, you'd want to explain, why was my car there or something, right? Like,
right.
You could see that she wanted to. So when she leaves, we're like, okay, this is, if it's not Colin, it's going to be her. If there's not something together with them, right? Like mm-hmm. if they're not working together.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, it's a possibility.
No, that's a possibility, right?
Like, we don't know what the motive was.
Right.
You know, we're thinking at the point now we're talking about a jealous thing. It's a rage thing, which would be evident, like, when you find out from Colin that it's, you know, I dropped her off on my motorcycle and went, and then you're like, oh man, it's the car. Well, then you can see in your mind, based on what you know of how many times Mo was shot, where she was shot, right. that this was some sort of rage, which fits with, okay, real jealous right. girlfriend.
Right.
So.
And although you have videotape of the car, you can't actually see Caitlin driving.
Can't see Caitlin driving.
Right.
You can't see Caitlin go out. The other thing too, that I think Caitlin did, was Mo's bike's missing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was found in a field, an adjacent field.
Right.
And so you're thinking, well, someone's trying to make this look like maybe it was a theft, because the bike's worth like 10 grand.
Right.
And so we're also dealing with, all right, I mean, could someone have stolen the bike to try to make it, was it a theft gone bad?
Right.
You know, but a lot of times we don't have people getting shot over a bike, but you never know with crazy people that are walking around the street. So
right.
I guess from the time she comes in and then to the time we get a warrant, yes, we're focused on Caitlin as mm-hmm. being the main person, but as other things come in, we're still vetting those other things. It's not like we're like, right. hey, this is our person.
Right.
So we're going through other leads, other tips. We're making sure that Colin's story does pan out. There was no doubling back. You know, right. he didn't know things. There's right. no communication between, you know, as detectives go on. We're doing all those things that you would do. You're looking at phone records because you're trying to figure out, well, did Colin and her, for whatever reason, there's something that we don't know financially that maybe Mo was involved with that right. cost them money. So we're trying to make sure that we're not missing,
right.
especially with Colin, you know, having the guns. He bought the guns.
Yeah, just because we have her as the person that we think most likely did it, we can't ignore any other evidence that comes in.
Right.
I mean, the goal is to find the truth of what happened and who killed Mo. So that requires the investigators to look at every possibility. It's right. not, you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket. You're not going to blind yourself to other possibilities.
Right.
You're going
to
investigate.
You have to be willing to pivot based on how the evidence presents itself.
You follow the evidence.
Okay.
Correct.
And I think some of the interesting things that we found out and they have since changed is from a standpoint of just people, I think, don't understand how much with all the apps and stuff that we use on a daily basis, how much of our personal lives are out there. And in this case, for instance, we know Mo came into town to stay right. and she was going to do this race.
Right.
And so when we're thinking, all right, well, Colin's saying he dropped her off, you know, could this be some random fan, you know? And they're like, well, how would she know we're staying? Well, it turns out like Mo would constantly use Strava to do her races or when she did her training sessions. So she'd start on the app and it would start, hey, this is how many miles you're going in your route. And then after when you're done, it shows up on a map.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, because we're like, well, how would Caitlin know where Mo is if she wasn't following Colin?
Uh-huh.
But it turns out like that day she did a training ride and on Strava, which is a public profile that I'm sure Caitlin's aware of because a lot of riders put out their workouts and stuff they do. It shows her starting there and ending her ride.
Oh,
so
wow.
even if okay. Caitlin wasn't sure, like she knows Colin's out somewhere, she right. had a spot already that she could have known to go and set up on to watch.
Check. Right.
Because of from Strava. And they've since, I use Strava a little bit. And they've since changed that. You can now, when you log on, they can change your starting point and your end point by an eighth of a mile if you request it. So it's not showing where you're
right,
at.
Right, right. But it's a promotional tool for professional cyclists.
Right. So, right. you know, we're even going through stuff like, well, if Colin, if it's not, who else could it be, right? Because you don't right. want to ever shut it down that it's someone else until you're, all right, got sure. gun match and stuff. Because at that point, we don't have the ballistics. We don't have that certainty.
Right.
We're still working through things.
And at this point, you don't know whether Caitlin had a tracker on Colin's bike or whether or not she used Strava or whether she followed them.
Correct.
Right.
So
there's several theories.
There's several theories. And again, based on the scene and from what we saw, you're thinking rage from somebody.
Right.
On what angle? And that was on the first, like back to when I mentioned, you know, you're trying to fit in, okay, well, if Colin did this, why would Colin have done it? Well, he's living with a girl. They have financial stuff together. Did Mo just drop some bombshell on him, right? That he's mm-hmm. She's coming to confront or tell Caitlin something.
Right.
And so he did it because you're trying to figure out the motive in your mind
sure.
too, because it's got to fit, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the thing. So it takes, you know, a while
right.
to figure
yeah.
it out.
So you're convinced that it is Caitlin. A warrant is issued for her arrest. And then the case is adopted by the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force because it's a violent crime and there is a gun that has been tied to Caitlin. So this is no longer an investigative case where you're trying to figure out who did it. You believe that you know who did it, and it now becomes the Lone Star Fugitive Task Force's job to find the body. Is that safe to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So what happens next now that it is a task force case?
Right. So the warrant is issued on May 17th and immediately the task force is on it. The APD TFOs have already been on the case from the beginning and have gathered information. We learned that she had purchased a new phone because her phone was seized during a search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of when she purchased the phone at a local Walmart, she had also bought a prepaid debit card.
Right.
And that will come in later. So we start doing our normal things. We check all the addresses that we have for someone, set up surveillance. We identified that her sister, based on our records, lives in Austin, mm-hmm. and we found that address. And we ended up making contact with management there. And through that process, we'd learned that the sister had actually sublet her apartment and was now living in New York.
Right.
One of the TFOs made contact with the lady who's now leasing Christy Armstrong's apartment
mm-hmm.
and learned that she had didn't know Christy, but she had found the room through social media, and the room was listed for a really great price, but she had one condition, and that was that she would also have to pay approximately $2,000 for all the furniture in the apartment, everything. So when she moved in, it was as if Christy just left the apartment, left everything she had behind, and she moved in. And when this lady goes to move in the apartment, she walks in, she finds Caitlin Armstrong in the apartment, and she is basically, for lack of a better word, ransacking it, going through everything. And she was obviously very surprised, like, you know, I just moved in and I don't know you, and now this place is a mess. Mm-hmm. It's just a very weird situation.
Right.
We learned that Christy moved to upstate New York. At least I'm from Texas. Anything outside of New York City to me is considered upstate. I don't know if it is or not.
Yeah, it's Hudson Valley. It's up a little bit.
And was basically kind of living in like a commune type little community.
Mm-hmm. You never at this point find out why was she in the apartment and what was she looking for?
Correct. May 18th, we learned Caitlin had traveled to New York. Mm-hmm. We're operating under the assumption that she was still in the Austin area or, you know, vicinity. And at this point, I start thinking, okay, well, this has changed the game quite a bit.
Right.
And now, you know, we're not just a local case. This is, you know, a national case. And I start thinking, okay, she's already traveled once. Could she be traveling more?
Right.
And at this point, we had already flagged her information for international travel. So if she tried to book an international flight, we would be notified.
Right. Okay.
But we hadn't received any notification.
Right.
So far. So at this point, I start thinking back to evidence that I had personally seen that was gathered during the search warrant of her house in the homicide investigation. And I recalled seeing a photograph of a passport card that belonged to her sister, Christy Armstrong.
Uh-huh.
And this kind of stuck out in my mind. Like, why would someone have another person's passport card in their residence when this person has moved out of state? You know, that's right. Something that you would usually take with you because mm-hmm. that's a very personal item right. to have. You're not just going to leave that laying around.
Right.
And so at this point, I made the connection like, hey, we need to check to see Christy Armstrong's travel history.
Mm-hmm.
So I made contact with one of our task force officers who works for Homeland Security. And we quickly learned that a Christy Armstrong had flown out of Newark
right.
Airport on the 17th of May, so just the previous day, to Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. And so this is now Friday afternoon, like 4 o'clock here locally. So at this point, we need to figure out, was this Christy Armstrong on the plane, and is this a coincidence?
Right.
Or did Caitlin travel out of the country on Christy's passport?
Check.
Actually, I think you put that out on Thursday to everybody because I remember firing off something to international either that Thursday or that Friday.
And I think that's one of the benefits of being on a task force because everyone's vested in the case. Whereas if you're not in a task force and you're trying to get this information from someone that's not vested in
right.
the investigation,
right.
it's going to take you a day or two to get that information back.
Right.
Whereas when everyone's invested in that investigation,
right.
that information flows
right.
so quick.
Well, the TV's fallacy, of course, is because you only have an hour to solve a case, is that every member of law enforcement has access to every law enforcement database on the planet. And I have found through doing this podcast that is so far from the truth that you don't have the universal access button, that you have to know people in different places if you want to get it faster. But it requires relationships and effort to get the information at all and to get it faster.
I remember that it was it was Friday afternoon that we needed to find Christy because
right.
we had to send a lead up to New York.
Right.
And so New York's obviously an hour ahead of the time here. And I'm thinking, man, it's 5:30 on a Friday in May. The task force guys up there, like, I know when it's Friday, like, I am spent. I want to go home, spend time with my family. And now some local TFO from Austin is reaching out, asking them to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours out of their way to go and meet with someone, because we need to put eyes on her to confirm whether Christy Armstrong's still in the country or not. And if Christy Armstrong's still in the country, Caitlin just fled the United States to Costa Rica.
Right.
We made that call to the Regional Fugitive Task Force in New York, and that inspector jumped on it.
Yep.
Without hesitation.
We knew she had flown out, but we still needed concrete proof, right? Like, we had some information that she bought a ticket. If I'm on the run, I'm not going north, I'm going south. You're a lot closer to south, right, if you killed someone.
Right.
So just because she bought this ticket to New York, we wanted to make sure that we knew that she got on that plane.
Check.
So we go out to the airport, we pull video, we get with our APD comms out there, we review footage, and we get her getting in with a yoga mat. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're like, okay, this is going to be her. Because at that time it was COVID. So she thinks she had a mask on when she was leaving our airport as Correct. Well. And then obviously that day when Riley were asking them to go up to put eyes on, we're also using our resources because we're part of the task force, trying to get someone to do the same thing on that end to see the person that boarded the plane to Costa Rica as well, in case we can't find her right off the bat. So if we can't find Christy, maybe we can use the photo of the person getting on the plane and to go to Costa Rica. Is Christy or is it Caitlin?
Yeah, these are all things that are going on simultaneously, that, you know, it's not just one person like having to do all this. It's like, hey, Amir, I need your help. Damien, I need your help. And they're taking it and running with it so that we can gather all this information as quick as possible, because at this point, time is of the essence. And it's great to have these resources
and
available.
Also, by this time, I've reached out to international at headquarters in Washington, D.C., and I'm advising them that it's probably going to turn into an international case where we can't be sure 100%, but I got to get the ball rolling on that side so that we can get some cooperation pretty quickly as well.
Right.
And I believe the 20th on that Friday was the first press release that we released as the Marshal Service on this case. And at that point, we had knew that she had flown out, but we didn't specify that in the press release because we were trying to narrow our tips down, because we were getting lots of tips. The first tip I remember us getting was from California, and the tip was, I saw this homeless lady, looked like Caitlin Armstrong, but on the tip I saw that the person described her having tattoos on both arms. Knew that wasn't Caitlin Armstrong. So there was no need to invest in that tip when we kind of knew the direction of travel already.
Right. And we should say that Regional Fugitive Task Force in New York went up and confirmed that Christy was, in fact, at the commune and had not traveled. So it was pretty definitive proof that it was probably Caitlin Armstrong traveling down to Costa Rica.
Right. And Chris, going back to, you know, the putting out the press release and not putting out that, you know, she had flown out of the country, that is very key information that we need to keep close to us, because if you know where someone is, you want them to get comfortable and you want them to stay there.
Right.
You don't want to put out anything that is going to make them feel like, okay, now I have to move again, because then we're just even further behind. So we would want to direct tips so if people in Costa Rica pay attention to the news, they'd be on the lookout for her.
Check.
But at the same time, we don't want to give her the heads up that we know.
Right. You want to settle in Costa Rica and get into some routine.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, and I remember getting that call, going back to the original press release. At that time, I was assigned to operations. It was a thing here in the Austin Division where our supervisor kind of sends us over to operations over there at the federal courthouse to help out with those federal inmates, just to give us some downtime, just a time to decompress. You know, comes about, I guess you do about 5 weeks on enforcement and you do about a week in court where you can decompress. And so at this time, I'm not even apprised of the story of this, you know, type of warrant that's been issued or anything on Caitlin. So I get a call from Amir sometime in the week. It was either Wednesday or Thursday. And he goes, hey, I need to pick a bone with you and see what you think about this. But I got a case. I think it's going to be big. And I think we're going to need the public's help. And I said, okay. I said, well, there's a type of strategy involved. I said, how big do you want it to be? because time is of the essence, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that the media, if you want to push something out, push it out during the week, and push it out early in the morning, or you push it out immediately after lunch, because that's when the shifts change for the media here in the Austin area. So we talked to the beer, and I think they strategized here with Riley and McLeod and as well as Rhodes, and they said, hey, okay, this is going to be the go time. We'll send it out on Friday. I said, okay, Friday after lunch, let's go ahead and get this done. I said, because when the weekend comes, it's not going to be newsworthy, and you probably won't get as many viewers because people, you know, are out and about with their families or doing whatever leisure activities usually. So we put that together, strategically, and we disseminated that or distributed that press release Friday afternoon, and we were like, okay, let's sit and wait. You know, from that point forward, it soonly progressed into a national media, you know, interest.
Okay,
there by Monday morning.
Right. So you guys at this point know she's in Costa Rica. No one else does. But this now becomes an international operation, and there's a lot of things that are different about an international operation than a domestic operation. So what are the steps that occur, and how do you bring in the Costa Rican authorities?
Well, I think most of the guys on the task force are excellent fugitive hunters.
Mm-hmm.
But when it turns into an international fugitive hunt, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so I'm really glad that I have Amir here in the local office, go to him and be like, what do I do?
Right.
And that's when he, I mean, really steps up in coordinating that.
Right.
So I think, you know, the press release was on the 20th, which is a Friday. Then we had the weekend. We were getting a bunch of tips over the weekend. We're getting calls and emails from headquarters saying that, hey, we're getting a significant media on this case. On the 24th, I believe, I get in communication with our domestic investigations branch. We're talking about making this case a major case. And the reason why we're talking about making this a major case is because the significant media attention. So at that point, they're like, yes, we need to make this a major case.
So major case means more resources, more people, more money, because without a major case, there are limitations even for you guys, right? In terms of how much money you can spend doing what. It's not the sexy part of law enforcement, but you guys have to pay Austin PD guys on the task force overtime, and you have to manage that budget, yeah?
That's correct. And a big difference being when you're dealing with a major case is that's when you start getting a reward. And I believe in this case, they authorized us $5,000.
Why does anyone care about this particular case? Homicides occur quite frequently in Austin and throughout the rest of the country. So why this case?
I think it's that love triangle. It goes back to that, the pure, I think everyone can maybe in their own mind.
Well, and they're two of the key players are professional athletes.
Well, yeah, you've got the Red Bull, you've got that. And the professional, but it also, I think, too, everyone can in their mind had a time when they were somewhat jealous of some sort of relationship growing up. So they can kind of see, they just never, obviously never got to that rage situation, right? And so I think there's that classic, you know, twist. There's this affair going on and there's all that stuff. So besides them being pro athletes and I mean, I guess cycling is big in Austin, I mean, is it?
So Chris, how did you pitch this to headquarters to get this elevated?
It was really pretty easy. I think one of the emails I sent, it had several of the links to some of the news articles that had already been coming out about the case.
Mm-hmm.
So they were already seeing that this case had significant media attention, and that is one of the requirements for a case to be a major case, is that it's getting regional or national news. And over the weekend, we had already hit the national news level on this case.
Right.
And actually, on top of that, International was already taking a look at it. This had made it big on the media. And so it was turning into something much bigger than just a regular case that we...
Right. And the photo of this case was not your typical mugshot of a homicide suspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't a jail photo. It was a nice photo, like a glamour shot photo.
I think social media, that's why it took off.
It took off.
Right. So when you deal with an international case, lots of things change, namely your jurisdiction. You've got none.
That's correct. We don't have any jurisdiction. We have leverage more than anything else.
Okay.
Because we are the United States.
Yes.
So we have embassies all throughout the world. So we are able to leverage that influence that we have in other countries.
Right.
And so that's what we use. having a lot of experience in international cases, mostly in Mexico, we know exactly the few steps that we need to take. The first ones are always going to be the same with any country,
right.
Which is, does this person have any legal status in that country?
Mm-hmm.
Is she able to reside in that country as a U.S. citizen? As a Costa Rican, because this is a country that we're dealing with.
Right.
Or does she have any type of status, legal, permanent status at that country? If that person doesn't have any legal status in that country, that means that that person's removable.
Well, there's also a couple other events that are going on during this time. There is a manhunt that's been going on for a couple weeks on a fugitive up in our Waco area. This guy was on the run for 3 weeks. We're in the middle of that, assisting the local agencies with. At this time, I have at least two TFOs up there and another deputy. And then the date that this case was upgraded to a major case was May 24th. May 24th was the date of Uvalde.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things are happening in this district.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff going on. And as a supervisor, I'm sending people to these different places and doing these different things. And I'm trying to say, hey, this case is really big, really huge. We need to put more resources into it. But we have these other things going on mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to also think that our headquarters is dealing with these other events as well.
Check.
And here I am talking about this murder case that at face value, a lot of people, it's a murder. We deal with a lot of murders, but they don't really think it is going to be as big as it's going to get. And
right.
it gets just continually just grows and grows and grows.
Right.
So going back to the international
check.
Stuff, those are the first boxes that we check, right? Does
right.
this person have any status in that country? But that's how you start. Those are the first questions that you're going to ask.
Right.
Right away. Does this person have... And obviously, what's the motive of going right. to Costa Rica? That's one of the things that you want to...
What's the connection?
And it will matter what country it is, because some countries we don't have fantastic relationships with.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
I guess the benefit of it being Costa Rica is... I mean, you can speak to that. Our relationships are quite strong down there, no?
I think they're pretty good. With the experience with this case, I didn't know exactly how good our relations were,
mm-hmm.
but it seems the United States has pretty good relations with Costa Rica.
Right. Okay, so she's going to Costa Rica. International and State
sure.
Department are talking to the Costa Rican authorities. You know she's in Costa Rica. The world, again, does not know. So you guys, probably the next day, run to the airport, get on a plane, charter a jet. The United States has unlimited resources. You're probably down there by 5 p.m.
Not.
No.
Not.
So a lot of things have to take place before we do that. When one of the questions right away is going to be like, well, does she have legal status?
First question, did she have legal status?
No. Not that we could find. And the fact that... she was a U.S. citizen, kind of played in our favor a little bit, right? I mean, that's what we knew.
Well, and the fact that she traveled to Costa Rica, apparently, using mm-hmm. Christy Armstrong's passport. So
right.
she's not traveling under her official passport, which I think also plays into it as well.
She will have now broken the law in Costa Rica as well.
Correct. She entered illegally.
And one thing to think about is that now that she is outside the country, those things that we do that we can do really quickly,
right.
like send someone to the airport to look at footage, to interview people. Now we have to go through processes to get that information to someone over there to do that for us, which could take maybe a day, 2 days, 3 days, just to get them to do something as simple
right.
as check for video footage.
Was there a red notice issued on
yes.
her?
Yes.
Absolutely.
That was expedited?
I filled it
yes.
out.
That is awesome.
I filled it out and...
Red notice takes months for it to be approved.
Define an actual red notice. What does that actually mean?
It's basically what it stands for. It's just a notice. Red is just a color that Interpol has assigned to it because of the severity that you had
okay.
attached to it. Most of the times it's because there is a warrant for the arrest of this person in the country that requested it.
Interpol puts out the red notice?
That is correct. But it's not an arrest warrant. You cannot detain this person
uh-huh.
based on a red notice. It's just a notice.
Okay.
It's telling the other country, the foreign country, telling
right.
them, hey, this person has an arrest warrant or is being investigated in this country for
okay.
this or that.
Right.
And we want you to collect as much information as possible
for this person so that a week later probably find them out.
Right. So when a red notice goes out, it's global?
It is global. It is global. That is correct. Okay. It is global and it's issued out of France.
Okay. Interesting.
The strongest part of that red notice is that it deters them from traveling. And each country has their own laws, like he said.
Right.
Each country may or may not enforce that red notice, right, even though they accept it and they are part of, because actually you have to be part of the red notice as well, of the agreement,
right,
to issue out a red notice.
But so, no country really wants somebody who's just committed a homicide coming into their country, I would also assume.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. Right. You would think so.
Okay.
It depends on...
Depends on the relations with, yes, the United States. Check. If they have bad relations with the United States, they're not really going to care.
Right. Okay.
I think it was around the 25th that we decided to release the footage of Caitlin at the airport with the yoga mat to kind of spur up some more media attention. Mm-hmm. We already knew she was in Costa Rica at this point, but we put that out there to see if we could get some more tips, maybe some from Costa Rica, and to continue the momentum that was going on with,
right,
the case.
Right. I know you guys want to get down to Costa Rica. It took a little bit.
It took,
I think we got approval around
a month after
us on about the 16th of June to start getting people ready to go to Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm. Was there a reluctance initially to send people?
There was a little reluctance at first. I think when initially we were dealing,
not from my part.
Yeah, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't on our end. But
And then you have to remember what he said. There was multiple other things going on,
right,
in this district that you have to actually take into account.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And also we were dealing with international. And I think Costa Rica was one of those cases where they actually had some assets on the ground that worked well with our international. So they thought that they were going to be able to take care of this. It was kind of like, hey, you know, we've got kind of like a team on the ground that can handle this.
Right.
So let's let them do their thing.
Right.
So we were constantly sending what we could to them. And it just didn't pan out that worked. You know, we need our guys on the ground there.
Right. Fell to you, Amir. You were going to be the one that was going to make the trip down to Costa Rica?
So, yeah. Actually, as soon as we found out, I thought, well, there's a possibility that maybe I could go down there and look for her.
Mm-hmm.
So, I want to say right around when it became a major case, I walked into Chris's office and I said, put me in, coach. I'm ready to go.
Uh-huh.
Just send me to Costa Rica.
Right.
I think he laughed and said, I don't think we're there yet. We're still working with the State Department, and they have a pretty good team on the ground over there.
But as we know, and as we've talked about in other podcasts, nobody really does a fugitive hunt like the Marshals.
Not really.
You're not ever going to beat having boots in the ground, yeah, and having that information come back to you right away.
Right.
Because a lot of that, again, it takes days for that information to come back. And then sometimes you feel like you're pushing. You're pushing too much for this, you know, mm-hmm, and you don't want to aggravate anyone or create frictions,
right,
with anybody, you know.
Okay.
It's a very political scene
and delicate. It's delicate.
Yeah, it's very delicate.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. I mean, you're not, these people don't work for you. I mean, they have, right, their own regular jobs, and you're asking them to do something on your behalf.
Drop everything and come and do my case.
Right.
It's just not the way it, yeah, happens. So when you show up, and that's the strongest thing that you can do, is show up. Because when you show up, then they're going to realize, all right, these people are serious. They, mm-hmm, really want to catch this person.
Right.
Now we're going to go, right, above and beyond.
Because they're kind of used to getting leads from various countries of people who may have committed crimes that are in Costa Rica. And here, guys, you know, now we've given it to you, Costa Ricans, go find them. And if you two show up on the ground, it means, no. We're not putting it in your hands.
Yeah, this one means business.
Yeah.
Like, we really want this done.
Right.
So I think I got a
fair
call from Amir, and I was working another case, one of the other cases that, mm-hmm, Chris just mentioned earlier. I was working that case, and I remember Amir calling me and is like, hey, are you interested in helping me out with this case?
Right.
At this point, I had no idea what was going on with this case because, mm-hmm, I was 100% on this other case.
Right.
So he calls me, tells me, and he calls me, obviously, we worked together in the past, came up in El Paso together. We worked a bunch of cases, a lot of international cases together.
Right.
So he's like, all right, I know you can help me.
Right.
Because of the experience that you have.
Right.
do you want to come to Costa Rica and help me out?
Right.
And everyone thinks, hey, Costa Rica, right? Like, I'm on board right away. Right, and I'm like, right. Nah, hold on. Let me call my wife. I just spent like 2 weeks away from home working this other case.
Right.
I have to get permission from the boss to go help you out.
So and Amir, you had said that, you know, it could have been a lot of people, but it was really important to you that you speak Spanish and you wanted to take someone else who is Spanish speaking with you as well.
Yeah, I think there was a number of people here in the office. There was a number of people here in the office that actually wanted to go as well.
Right.
But to me, it was really important that I found somebody that spoke the language, spoke Spanish, and that could run on his own.
And that's going to do it for part one of this 3-part fugitive hunt for Caitlin Armstrong. In episode 2, the Marshals embark on a mission to find a needle in a haystack. They know Caitlin Armstrong's in Costa Rica. They don't know where she is, what name she's using, or how she may have changed her appearance. They do know one thing, though. There is a ticking clock. The time they can spend in Costa Rica is limited. The help they'll get from the Costa Rican government is temporary. Don't miss episode 2, premiering next Wednesday, May 1st. Thanks to all my guests today from the Austin Police Department and the U.S. Marshal Service. They'll be back next week. In the meantime, please tell your friends about Chasing Evil and give us a 5-star rating and a review if you have a sec on Apple or Spotify. We would really appreciate it. And finally, Chasing Evil is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshal Service. It contains interviews with current and retired employees as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the United States Marshal Service. Stay safe, everyone.